for stars being tidally disrupted, or by stars or compact objects which can be directly captured into the black hole. So this radius of closest passage would be either like 2 times or 4 times Schwarzschild radius for 4 times, sorry, for a direct capture, or it could be much larger, but still like a certain multiple of Schwarzschild radius for a tidal disruption when the star getting here is just torn away and then the gas spirals into the black hole. But in any case, what would be relevant to the talk is the critical angular momentum, which I define in this way. So the question is how to get the stars to the low angular momentum region, which is which will be called throughout the talk the loss cone. So the origin of the term loss cone comes from this geometrical picture that a star at a certain distance far enough from the black hole can have a velocity vector directed within a certain cone. That star would be captured by the black hole. If the velocity is directed elsewhere, then it will not be captured. So the cone refers to the cone in the velocity space, but later on I'll be speaking about the loss cone or loss region in the phase space, of the, in the phase of the integral of motion. I still be using the term loss cone. The primary application of all this is stellar dynamics in the galactic nuclei or nuclear star clusters. I will use these terms interchangeably. And what does the nucleus is composed of? It is composed, obviously, of a supermassive black hole. The masses would be from 10 to 6 to 10 to 9 solar masses, for example. And obviously, there is a stellar distribution around the black hole. So normally, we assume that this stellar distribution is a sort of power law profile and radius, and the power law would be just here, the power law with slope gamma. So the total gravitational potential of this distribution of matter is created by the black hole, obviously, and I will not be invoking any relativistic effect, so I just write down the Newtonian potential of the black hole. And then this is the contribution from the stellar potential from the distributed mass. And so this is the spherically symmetric term. And as I promised, I will be speaking mostly about the non-spherical galaxies. So I add the contribution from which breaks the spherical symmetry. If I only take these two terms, that would be the axially symmetric case. So the zeta axis would be the axis of rotation symmetry. And if I add another term, then it would be a triaxial case where all three principal axes are different from each other. So these coefficients are assumed to be not very large. They may be of order unity, but normally you would think that the galaxy is flattened, but not very highly flattened. So these coefficients, epsilon and theta, would be small. And since I'm considering the motion close to the black hole, it means that, in other words, the first term, this term is dominating the total potential. So the motion is, in the first approximation, it is a Keplerian ellipse, and then under the influence of the distributed mass, it is the ellipse itself is precessing. And so that precession is what essentially is important for studying how the orbits look like. But since the first term dominates, the radial motion, the motion along the ellipse, is fast, while the precessional motion is slow. So that's, there is a separation of time scales. And to show how does it look like, try to demonstrate an example of a precessing orbit. That is an orbit an orbit in three projections on three principal planes. The dot marks the position of the black hole, the focus of the ellipse, and that is an Keplerian ellipse in three projections, which is precessing in time. So the star is moving along the ellipse, but the ellipse itself is precessing. So in the intermediate time scales, it feels like sort of an annulus. And the annulus itself, the plane of the annulus is also precessing. So it is like moving back and forth. So in the long term run, the orbit looks like a sort of a torus, if you can imagine what is wrong here. So it's a torus with a tube, as we call it. And the angular momentum, which is plotted here in that panel, the angular momentum of an orbit is not constant. It oscillates back and forth. But in this particular case, it was oscillating slightly. But there can be also another sort of orbits which exist only in the triaxial potential. So these orbits, they exist in both axisymmetric and triaxial cases. The orbits which are peculiar to triaxial cases are so-called pyramid orbits. I'll show you how are they different from the tubes. So for pyramid orbits, again, this is a Keplerian ellipse, which is precessing, but now it does not have any preferred sense of precession. So remember, in that case, it was like moving in a sort of loop. But in the case of pyramid orbits, it does not have any preferred direction of oscillation. So it feels sort of a distorted rectangle in this projection, and in this projection, it's like a triangle. So to make an impression, how does it look like in three dimensions? So that is like a three-dimensional picture of the orbital types. These are tube orbits, and these are pyramid orbits. So it's like a pyramid, and the black hole is at the pinnacle of the pyramid, at the vertex. So the orbit looks like a very elongated ellipse, which is precessing back and forth. One of the edges of the ellipse is always near the black hole, and the other edges circumscribing the distorted rectangle. Why are these orbits important? Because in the previous picture, here again, I plotted the angular momentum, and it oscillates, and more importantly, it can actually get all the way down to zero. And since I'm going to speak about the capture events, that means to be captured, it needs to have a very low angular momentum. So essentially, all the stars on all pyramid orbits can, at some point in their life, in their precession cycle, they can acquire arbitrary low values of angular momentum. In other words, these orbits are called centrophilic. That means that stars from any pyramid orbit can be captured by a black hole just while precessing in the smooth potential of the stellar cusp. So these orbits are important for the triaxial case. While for the axisymmetric case, we have tube orbits. We have also some subclass of tube orbits, so-called saucers. Probably will not go much into details anyway. So to summarize, how does the motion of stars look in the galactic nuclei? It is decomposed into fast motion and slow motion. The fast motion is along the Keplerian ellipse, and the slow motion is the precession of the Keplerian ellipse. And this separation of timescales is, in many cases, I think maybe it's a very generic result in physics that if you have separation of timescales, you can do a sort of orbit averaging, average the motion over the fast variable and obtain the Hamiltonian, which describes the evolution of the slow variables. So in the case of orbits around black holes, it allows to write down the motion in terms of the secular Hamiltonian, the orbit average Hamiltonian. And it turns out that the motion is entirely integrable, which is a quite non-trivial result, because normally we are sure that the motion is completely integrable in the spherically symmetric case, but we cannot be sure that in the case of a broken symmetry. All we know that in the axial symmetry, there is a z component of angular momentum, which is also conserved. But it turns out that near the black hole, there is a third integral of motion. So the motion has three integrals: energy, z component of angular momentum, and the secular integral of motion. In the triaxial case, it's even less trivial, but because even the z component is not conserved, but there are two integrals of motion in addition to energy. So the motion is completely integrable. And here I again plot the evolution, the time evolution of angular momentum. And it basically summarizes the previous slides. So for any kind of orbit, the angular momentum is not conserved. It rather oscillates between some minimum and maximum value. And of course, the most interesting. Yeah, sure, yeah.
Can't LZ be an integral of motion and then the star goes all the way to the center?
Not really. Well, if in the axisymmetric case, if LZ is integral of motion, then of course the lower limit on angular momentum would be no less than LZ.
Okay.
It could be larger, but for many orbits, it is close to LZ. But what is important is that if you don't probably have that slide, but I can just do a hand waving argument. If you consider the spherical case, then and count the number of stars which have angular momentum less than a given threshold, a small threshold, that number would be proportional to L squared, where L is the value of the threshold. If you only consider the Z component of angular momentum and count the number of stars, it would be proportional to the first power of L. So that means that obviously there are many more stars which have only the Z component of angular momentum less than a given value, because the other two components may be still large and the star still will have a small value of the Z component. That means that in principle, in the axisymmetric case, you would expect that there are many more stars than that could get below a certain, they could not get all the way to zero, but they can get below a certain small threshold necessary for the capture. And in the triaxial case, this fraction can be of order unity. The next.
So the statement you were making that there are three integrals of motion, that's in a special case, that if you have axisymmetry and very close to black hole, or?
Yes, so all this treatment is valid for small radii, more specifically for radii smaller than the so-called influence radius, which is defined as the radius containing stellar mass equal to the mass of the black hole. So if you are considering much smaller radii, then there is the separation of time scales, so the fast radial motion and slow precessional motion. So that is one requirement. If you are going, if you are approaching the influence radius and go beyond that, then there is a lot of a large fraction of phase spaces occupied by chaotic orbits, because there is the resonance interaction which destroys this integrability of the system. The chaotic orbits actually are also important because, again, I don't know whether it can be proven strictly, rigorously, but it turns out that most of the chaotic orbits, they also can get to arbitrary low values of angular momentum. So these orbits are also important, like beyond the radius of influence. So I'm slowly coming to the concept of this lost region or lost cone, and why it is more why it is larger in the non-spherical systems. So that's what I already started to explain that. So just to summarize, in the case where angular momentum is not conserved, we obviously have many more stars which can have lower limit on the angular momentum less than the capture boundary. Because the star can have the angular momentum oscillating back and forth from the previous picture. It can have an average angular momentum somewhere there, but the lower value of angular momentum would be dropping to very low quantities. That's not exactly zero, but it may be very close to zero. And for a triaxial case, for pyramid orbits, all these orbits, regardless of what is their average angular momentum, all these orbits can actually get to close to the black hole at some point in the precession cycle. So the difference is that in the axisymmetric case, we have a much larger fraction, but a much larger fraction of orbits in this lost region. It still depends on the boundary of the region of the on the capture boundary, because it needs to have LZ less than the boundary. For the triaxial case, this fraction of loss region orbits does not even depend on the capture boundary. All of them are centrophilic, and the fraction of these pyramid orbits in this total distribution is of order epsilon. So that means maybe 10% or so, maybe 50%, maybe an overestimate. Anyway, so the differences between three cases with a decreasing symmetry is that when we go from spherical to axisymmetric to triaxial systems, we have increasing number of stars in the loss region, which have the minimum value of angular momentum less than the capture boundary. So in the spherical case, it is proportional to the boundary squared. In this case, it is proportional to the first power of capture boundary. In this case, it's so independent. But on the other hand, this increase of the orbits is balanced by, to some extent, balanced by the probability of any such orbit to be captured in per unit time. So essentially for the spherical case, if you have an instantaneous value of angular momentum less than capture boundary, then it does not change, right? So it would be captured within one radial period. In the triaxial case, you see that there is a lot of oscillation, and the survival time of stars on these pyramid orbits can be even longer than the Hubble time. So they essentially, at some point in their life, they can get into the black hole, but that lifetime can be very long. And the axisymmetric case is somewhere in between these two extremes. So now we have a much larger reservoir of orbits, but we still need to wait long enough to get them there. And all the previous discussion was based on the orbits in the smooth potential. So it was, we represented the stellar cluster as like a smooth distribution of mass. While in reality, of course, it is not so, because it is composed of individual stars, and stars are interacting with each other. And that means two-body relaxation. So in addition to these smooth potential effects, the precession of stars in the smooth potential, there is also a change in the energy and angular momentum of stars because of two-body relaxation, because of pairwise interactions. And now I come to that. I'll start again with the spherical case. Mm. For the spherical case, we have a well-defined, we have a well-defined notion of relaxation time, which is the mean time for the pairwise interactions, for the two-body scattering events to change the energy or angular momentum of a star of order of itself. And this time is typically very long. In the galaxy, so it can be short in systems, in compact systems like global clusters, but in galactic nuclei, especially in the giant galaxies where the density of stars is fairly low, this time the relaxation time is sometimes many orders of magnitude larger than the Hubble time. But that's obviously a useful time scale which will determine the subsequent part of my talk. So the relaxation time, or alternatively, I will be using the term diffusion time, or in inverse of a diffusion coefficient. So the relaxation, now I probably have to draw something. So if I plot the time dependence of, say, angular momentum squared. Okay, for the spherical case without any relaxation, it would be just straight line, right? For non-spherical case, it would be regular oscillations. And also, if we switch on the relaxation, that means that there is some kind of jitter. So it's sort of a random walk. So in the general case where we have both relaxation and the regular precession, it would be these regular oscillations superimposed over this random walk. And we need to consider both processes to see how often stars can get below the capture boundary. But to start with the spherical case, there is an important distinction between empty and full loss cone regimes. So what does it mean? Obviously, in order to be captured, a star needs to have angular momentum lower than the boundary. But also, it needs to be to pass at the pericenter of the orbit while having this low angular momentum. If it has the angular momentum below the boundary while it is far from the black hole, but then the relaxation would change the angular momentum before it gets to the pericenter, then it can avoid the capture. So now we have the time scale for changing the angular momentum near the capture boundary by the order of itself. And of course, it is much smaller than the relaxation time, because the relaxation time means that a typical angular momentum, like of a circular orbit, would be changing by order of itself. While near the capture boundary, we only need to change the angular momentum by a small quantity in order to get out or to get into the loss cone. So the time scale of diffusing in and out the loss cone would be a small fraction of the relaxation time. And this should be compared to the radial period. So it can be either larger or smaller than the radial period. And in one case, it would be called empty, and the other case would be called full loss cone regimes. Why? Yeah, sure.
This thing about the superposition of jitter and oscillations, is that jitter is important that it would be might have a significantly larger amplitude closer in, where the when the angular momentum oscillates down.
Mm-hmm.
To the, is that when you estimate the jitter, you're going to estimate it at the inner?
So the jitter is a sort of a random walk process. For the random walk process, the mean change is proportional to square root of time. So if you're considering very small time intervals, of course, it would be much larger than the regular change. But we need to consider finite time intervals, for example, compared to one radial period or whatever. So in that case, the jitter may be smaller or larger than the regular precession. It actually turns out that in most realistic cases, if you have the regular precession, then the jitter is kind of small compared to that. So it is the regular precession is more important in changing the angular momentum. But
I guess I'm saying that it also seems like it would be, you might expect it to be quite highly correlated because the because of that smaller radii, that the density
mm-hmm.
would be a lot higher.
Mm-hmm. That's true. On the other hand, it's not that straightforward. Actually, if one computes the diffusion coefficients or the mean time scale of the jitter, it would actually decrease with the angular momentum. So here it would be smaller than here. So even though the density in the center is larger, but it is balanced by that's just a medical fact that it's not that straightforward. But of course, there is a well-defined timescale associated with this jitter. So I wanted to say to explain why these terms are called as they are called, why it is empty and full versus full. And so for here I just kind of plotted the same thing as I tried to draw on the board. Given an ensemble of stars, so this is the time goes along this axis, and this is the angular momentum squared. And we may start with a certain distribution of stars with some given values of initial angular momentum, and then they experience this random walk. And for the case where the random walk is, the time scale for the random walk is long compared with the radial period, we have the following situation. We start from the empty loss cone. There are no stars below the capture boundary. Then over time, some of them manage to diffuse into this region. Then they are captured on the next pericenter passage after one radial period. Again, then some stars manage to diffuse here again, but overall this region of phase space remains relatively empty. There are very few stars here on average. While in the full loss cone regime, when the relaxation is very efficient, even though stars are cleared at the pericenter passage, they manage to diffuse into this region very efficiently. So most of the time, the density of stars in the loss region is the same as outside. That's why it is called full loss cone. So there is a quantity which I called Q, which distinguishes between the empty and full loss cone regimes. And of course, that depends on the on energy or on the radius of the stellar orbit, because the radial period depends on the size of the orbit. So normally, you would expect that very close to the black hole, the radial period is short. So we are in the empty loss cone regime because the diffusion time scale is longer than the radial period. While further out, we may not go into the full loss cone regimes. It turns out that for relatively small galactic nuclei like our Milky Way, the transition between the empty and the full loss cone regime happens around the influence radius. While for very massive galaxies and very massive black holes, essentially everything is within the empty loss cone regime. So why this distinction is important? Because apart from specifying what's the fraction, what's the density of stars in the loss cone, it actually also defines the average capture rate by the following argument. It's not very straightforward, but I try to do my best to explain it. So again, so far I'm speaking about the spherical case. I'll come up to the non-spherical case on the next slide. For the spherical case, the theory was developed in the 70s, and the steady state or quasi steady state distribution of stars is described by a steady state solution of a Fokker-Planck equation, where we have the diffusion coefficients calculated from the relaxation time, and we have a capture boundary at the tidal disruption radius. So we are solving for the distribution function in angular momentum, scaled by the angular momentum of circular orbit, so that varies from zero to unity. And so n is the distribution function of stars. Normally, the collisions, the encounters between stars, the relaxation phenomena, they tend to drive the distribution function towards isotropy. So in that case, it would be just a constant. Since we have a sink at the lower angular momentum, we have the distribution function somewhat depleted at the lower angular momentum region. But the empty and the full loss cone cases are distinguished by how much is it depleted. So for the empty loss cone cases, obviously, there are almost no stars in the loss cone. So the distribution function should go almost to zero at the boundary. And in the full loss cone case, as I explained, it is almost the density of stars in the loss cone is almost the same as everywhere. So it's almost constant. It's just slightly depleted here. And then if we calculate the capture rates, I'll probably start with the full loss cone regime. Okay, I should mention that this solution is actually has a form of a logarithm plus constant. So for the empty loss cone, it's just basically on the logarithm, there is no constant and goes to zero. While for the full loss cone, the coefficient at the logarithm is small, while the constant is almost the same as the average value of the distribution function. So now the question is, what does the capture rate depend on? And for the full loss cone case, again, the density of stars is almost uniform. So the number of stars captured per unit time is just the number of stars in this region, the size of this region, divided by orbital period, because this region is cleared every radial orbital period. So it depends only on the size of the region. It does not depend on the diffusion coefficients, as long as they are high enough to keep the loss cone full. So in the full loss cone regime, the magnitude of the diffusion coefficients does not play any role. And for the empty loss cone regime, it's the opposite situation. There are very few stars here, but the flux of stars from higher value of angular momentum is limited or determined by the diffusion coefficients, by gradient of the by slope of the distribution function multiplied by the diffusion coefficient. So in the empty loss cone regime, it is diffusion limited. It is determined. The capture rate is determined by the efficiency of relaxation. And in the full loss cone regime, the relaxation is so efficient that it does not really matter anymore. Only the size of the capture boundary matters. But since this is a logarithmic profile, I haven't written it down here, but the flux depends on the size of this loss region logarithmically. I should probably write it down on the blackboard. The average value of the distribution function divided by that parameter q that I defined earlier, plus logarithm of something of that sort. So in the empty loss cone regime, this is almost this is very small. This is almost zero. So the flux per unit time is determined by the value of the capture boundary. And in the full loss cone regime, these two things are. In the full loss cone regime, this does not matter because this is very large, but then it is balanced by the diffusion coefficient in the numerator. So these two cancel each other. So what is important is that in the empty loss cone regime, the dependence on the capture boundary is logarithmical. It is quite weak. Hello. Come on. Good. So now I come to the non-spherical case. As I explained, in that case, we have many more orbits potentially in this loss region. But they may stay in this region for a very long time. And Actually, there is a substantial difference between these axisymmetric and triaxial cases, because in the triaxial case, they may stay there for longer than Hubble time. So essentially, in the triaxial case, we'll have the we do not need any relaxation to sustain the flux of stars into the black hole, because there is always this region of phase space occupied by pyramid orbits remains still populated for a very long time. So they keep getting into the black hole. Very, very small probability for any individual star, but since the number of these stars is very large, so there is a more or less constant flux of the stars into the black hole, which does not depend on relaxation. Well, in the axisymmetric case, as well as in the spherical case, this loss region is emptied very quickly or drained very quickly. And then we need the relaxation to repopulate this region. So that was the main part of the work that I was doing for the last year, and I will not present it in any detail here. That was the solution of this two-dimensional diffusion equation. But the outline, the main result is that for the axisymmetric case, the main result is that the increased size of the loss region matters as long as it determines the size of the this capture boundary. And from what I've said before, it would only matter in the empty loss cone regime, because then the distribution function is non-uniform. It has a well-defined slope, and the capture rate is determined by the slope. While in the full loss cone regime, it would be a constant, so the capture rate would not matter, because as I explained, the increase in the number of stars in the loss region is balanced by the decrease of the probability of getting captured. So if you are in the full loss cone regime, the distribution function would be flat, and the capture rate would be the same as in the spherical case. It would only matter in the empty loss cone regime. And since the dependence on the capture boundary is logarithmic, the increase in the rates of capture of stars in the axisymmetric case versus a spherical case is moderate. It may be a factor of few, but not larger. While the triaxial case is different in the sense that it does not need any relaxation. There is the loss cone draining, which is more important than the relaxation. Of course, we do not know what not of course, but sadly, okay. Sadly, we don't know what the real galaxies look like. Whether they are probably not spherically symmetric. There is nothing symmetric in the nature. So, but we don't really know observationally how much flattened they are. We could expect them to be.
So we have observations of
stellar. Yes, but the problem is that here we are speaking about the very small radii. All the observations, of course, we see that there are disk galaxies, like spiral galaxies, which are flattened. There are elliptical galaxies which are flattened or distorted. But these all applies to much larger radii. We don't really have observations for.
But Sagittarius is a star, we can see.
Yes, only for our galaxy, we can resolve the region well within the influence radius with sufficient detail. But even for our galaxy, we actually, the problem is that observationally, the map of the stellar distribution is very patchy because of non-uniform extinction. Because the extinction of starlight by dust is very non-uniform and patchy. We cannot actually infer anything reasonable about the shape of the nuclear star cluster even in our galaxy, not to speak about the external galaxies. So all this discussion was kind of a little bit theoretical because we don't have any observational evidence of how much flattened could be galaxies. But we could expect them to be at least moderately flattened, or it's very likely for them to be at least moderately triaxial. So that means that on average, we would expect that the capture, the rates of interesting events, whether it would be capture or tidal disruption or and spiral, it would be larger than in the standard spherically symmetric picture. But from what I explained, it would not be much larger in the flattened case, in the axisymmetric case, while it could be substantially larger in the triaxial case. And so that needs to be taken into account. when evaluating the figures. But speaking about the numbers, if we evaluate the rate of these events for like for our galaxy or for giant galaxies like M87 or anything which has a large black hole, the rate of these events would be lower than one star in 10 to 4 years. So for our galaxy, the accumulated mass of the stars captured by the black hole would probably could contribute a significant fraction of the black hole mass, while for very large black holes, it would not be any significant source of the black hole mass increase. So that black hole mass is accumulated from gas capture or from the order of black holes, but really not from the stellar captures. But the rate of events, which are interesting from a astrophysical point of view, like the disruption flares or spirals, which could be the source of a gravitational wave, could be, it could be much larger than traditionally assumed. And also that applies to the binary black holes in the sense that I will be speaking about that tomorrow in the University of Waterloo. In the case of binary black hole, there is an you basically, in order for the black holes to merge, to coalesce, you need the orbit of the binary to shrink by a very large factor. And that can only be done by interaction with the stars of the galactic nucleus. So when the black hole, the separation between the black holes is very small, it can shrink by the emission of gravitational waves. But in order to get to such small radii, this is a small fraction of parsec, you need first to shrink it from, say, 1 parsec to 1 milliparsec by interaction with the stars. And again, in the spherical case, the number the stars which can potentially interact with the black hole would be very easily depleted, and the further decrease of the separation would stall. So that is the origin of the final parsec problem. And of course, what I was talking today about the effects on non-spherical perturbations on orbits would be important for could be important for the solution of the final parsec problem. It's not actually clear though whether it has been solved or not. So I will be speaking about that tomorrow. Thank you.
So you commented on stellar capture, but have you thought about the different observational signals that might be released by, say, the capture of a red giant or a red dwarf star? So you might expect the giant star to be torn up on the way, in which case it will release a substantial fraction of its binding energy as radiation or mechanical power. Whereas if you're grabbing dwarfs and you pull them in all at once and they're not shredded, then the amount of binding energy that's released, most of it will probably get injected into the hole, presumably.
I think the standard picture is that if a star gets tidally disrupted, then roughly half of its mass eventually gets into the black hole, while the other half is expelled outwards. That could be different for giants and white dwarfs because they have a very different internal structure.
Not just white dwarfs, but just regular
dwarfs. Or just main sequence stars. Yeah, that could be different. For the giants, for example, it's very likely that even if you strip a very some outer layers of a giant, it would not be disrupted because it's essentially the core of the giant which matters. You can easily strip out the outer envelope and then it will be regenerated very quickly. So in that case, you will probably need multiple pericenter passages in order to disrupt the star.
Right, but what I'm wondering about is just the observational signatures, the electromagnetic signatures in the two cases. I would think that they would differ dramatically.
They could be different, yeah. But my job is just to make the stars get into close to the black hole. I don't care what happens afterwards. There are other people who study that.
Yeah, I do have a question related to what was mentioning. Like, you have a neutron star and a black hole interacting. You may expect to have this kind of tidal disruption, which are kind of important and people are interested because of the electromagnetic counterpart that you have. So I was wondering, does have any of this study or statistics, because you didn't run embodied simulation, you don't solve the Fokker-Planck equation. So isn't the statistics applied for those cases?
The statistical of what?
Apply even independently of the structure of the nature of the star. So the same arguments that you use for the loss, for the loss points, mm-hmm. is useful if I consider neutron stars being disrupted by black holes.
I would say that all the processes here are the relaxation processes, the diffusion processes, or the regular precession does not really depend on the mass of the star or on the type of the star. It would be equally important for like stellar mass black holes or giant stars or main sequence stars. Well, the details only matter once you get close to the black hole. Then, of course, the stellar mass black hole would just be merged with the supermassive one, while the star would be disrupted, whatever. But so the statistics would be just reflecting the fraction of the different stellar populations in the galaxy core in general.
I think you're asking is, does this analysis apply to a neutron star orbiting around a stellar mass black hole?
Mass black hole.
The answer is no.
No?
Yeah, because...
No. Here, of course, what is implicitly assumed that the mass of the large black hole is much larger than the stellar mass. Yes. So it's like a many body problem. There are many, many small stars orbiting around a large massive black hole.
So the radius of influence has 10 to the 6 stars. So mm-hmm. why not just simulate like a million stars with one black hole?
Well, we did something of that sort. We have compared the solution of this Fokker-Planck diffusion equation with the direct in-body simulations. Although 10 to 6 stars is probably not infeasible, but for a really large galaxies, it would contain 10 to 8, 10 to 9 stars, which is still not feasible for the direct simulation. But in principle, that could be done. From our comparison, we can conclude that the Fokker-Planck description is accurate enough, at least within a factor of 2 from the more direct n-body simulations. But the point is that in the n-body simulations, since you cannot really simulate with a realistic number of stars, you will get the different proportion between the empty and the full Osconn regimes. So that is a subtle point, which I'm not sure I can explain it briefly. But essentially, the capture rates, they depend both on whether you are in the empty versus full Osconn regimes and on the number of stars. So the n-body simulations, they cannot reproduce the proportion between these two regimes in realistic galaxies because of the much larger number of stars in a real galaxy. But the Fokker-Planck studies, they can be adjusted to whatever kind of regime you can like.
But you haven't done Fokker-Planck for a triaxial?
Not for a triaxial case, yes. For the triaxial case, I was arguing that the relaxation may be not that much important because we are still in the draining regime, where we are just capturing stars from pyramid orbits due to regular precession.
So because it seems that the triaxial is the most interesting.
It seems that, yes. Yes.
And I mean, it seems that analytically it's harder to do, but if you have a simulation, you can just run it for triaxial.
Yes, yes. So we are in this work, we were mainly focusing on the axisymmetric case, like solving it in the most possible level of detail. While for the triaxial case, we can like do some kind of waving argument suggesting that the relaxation is not that much important, but while the draining rates are important. That can also be calculated, and it turns out that it is much higher than in the axisymmetric case. But no solution for relaxation process in the triaxial case was done. Although, again, that could be done in the n-body simulation, but not really in the regime which is relevant to realistic galaxies, because we still cannot afford the number of stars comparable to realistic galaxies.
But I mean, for Milky Way, it's not...
For Milky Way, it is not impossible, yes. I think that could be done, probably, yes. Maybe
so,
the next project.
Along those lines, I wanted to ask, so you mentioned difficulty in determining the potential, the structural potential of the Milky Way.
Mm-hmm.
A few windows, but there are these dynamical disks, right? These stellar disks quite
mm-hmm.
close to black holes.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine that those, their very existence, would place some constraints on how triaxial it could be.
Uh-huh.
Right? I was just interested, if those, are those interesting constraints? Or are they?
So first of all, the disks that we observe are relatively young. They have ages of a few mega years, and some of the stars from a more spherical population, they have ages of like 100 mega years. These are the stars for which we know more or less their, quite well their spatial distribution. We do not observe the majority of the stars in the galactic nucleus. They are very old and faint stars. We can just infer their presence by the overall dynamics of the test stars, say, the distribution of the bright stars. But those stars do not comprise the major part of the mass in the galactic center. So we, yeah, we, for the young stars, the constraints that could be placed on the degree of flattening or degree of triaxiality of the potential, I think they are very weak still.
Another question related to the galactic center is that there are a lot of simulations that suggest, at least on those scales, there ought to be substantial mass segregation. And naively, I would imagine that mass segregation would produce larger larger rates of low angular momentum stars flying in, right? You have more massive things interacting, so larger scatterings, faster diffusion, and they're already on low angular momentum orbits. So it's the best case scenario. I was wondering if that actually was significant.
Okay, so first of all, mass segregation does not mean that there are many more stars on low angular momentum orbits. That means that there are more tightly bound stars, but they could well be on circular orbits or near circular orbits. And that does not say anything about the distribution of angular momentum. But you're right that it can enhance the rate of relaxation. And so for our Milky Way, it's basically the only system that we know for sure for which the collisional effects are likely to be important. For the external galaxies, the relaxation times, like for giant galaxies, the relaxation times are very long. So essentially, if we are not in the triaxial case, then the relaxation would not be ever important because it's just too long. But for our Milky Way, well, again, we do not know exactly what would be the density of these stellar remnants or what's the degree of mass segregation. There are no real observational constraints on that.
One last, maybe very naive question. There's at least one other system where we can see low angular momentum objects on merely radio orbits, and that's the Oort cloud and comets. And so can you constrain the relevant physics that, that's being used here by looking at the dynamics of small solar system bodies?
Oh, that's very interesting. Because you know that, yeah, this solar system, I think it could be well approximated by the axisymmetric distribution of planets in the ecliptic plane. So in some sense, the dynamics of outer bodies in the solar system, probably, yeah, it has some similarities to what we have done here.
There you have a pretty decent rate of objects lowering mono orbits. So
Right. I think that's...
If you thought you knew the distribution of the slow mass objects in the Oort cloud, which is a big if. But if you think you did, then you could probably apply the machinery that you're using here to make a prediction for how many comets you should see.
I think though that in the case of our solar system, the perturbations on these outer bodies come from the external stars, not from the dynamics of the smaller bodies themselves. So if there is like a star passing within a few parsecs from our solar system, then it perturbs some of these bodies, so some of them end up being comets.
Okay.
So I think that's still a different mechanism.
So you may have answered this obliquely already, but I'll ask it anyway directly. So one of the interesting properties that galaxies has is that they get bigger and more luminous. Their cores get fainter and fainter, and the standard picture, which Dave Merritt has been the big exponent of, is these stars were flung out through dry mergers as black holes coalesce, and that's how they gridded them, shed the angular momentum, and merged. But is it completely out of the question that maybe a different scenario occurred, that these black holes were set in place very early on, and the reason why these big galaxies have faint cores is that the the distribution of orbits of these stars was favorable to being swallowed by the central hole. So this hole was actually grown by, I don't know, passive cannibalism, rather than active cannibalism. Is that, I gather from what you said earlier, that's not going to be relevant.
Yeah, I think that's not the case. Yeah, because the mechanism that I was considering here, they cannot basically carve a large enough hole in the galaxy, in the galaxy as a whole, because that core corresponds to like eliminating the mass of stars comparable to the mass of the black hole itself, which could probably be done by the three-body scattering involving the binary black hole. But then still it needs to be,
Is there no phase-space distribution of stars that, I mean, it might be just worth a whack, just trying to simulate it and see if it's, if even some weird distribution of stars could result in that sort of flattening. And then from that point, you can sort of rule out whether that distribution of stars is likely to occur in nature. Or would it, can you rule it out for any, you know, if you just had all low angular momentum orbits, could you do it, or would they have to have?
Okay, I think it's not the distribution in angular momentum which matters, because still the density profile is set by the distribution of stars in energy. Even if you eliminate like all of the low angular momentum space, the density profile would not change dramatically, because there are always stars on nearly circular orbits, and if the distribution is in energy so that there are many highly tightly bound stars, then you cannot erase the cusp by consuming the low angular momentum stars. You need to the very significant changes in the distribution and energy in order to erase it, which cannot be done by these processes.
So you're saying that most likely they would circularize and the whole thing would stop, since that's the minimum energy that they would achieve. So.
Well, okay. I'll probably explain it in more detail tomorrow.
Okay. Fine.
Yeah, I have more than answer.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.